Anything else?
Well, I really don't think so. There are minor stories that I could tell about Maurice just within the book trade, really. I'd certainly say it was a treat to work for him, an experience I'll never forget. Towards the end, we had our differences. He definitely wanted to slow down, and I got itchy. I wanted to move a little faster, and we had some arguments. So our parting in 1974, it was amicable, but it was the best thing, for sure. And there were some hard feelings between us, whether they were grounded on truth or not, I don't know, but he certainly sold me some wonderful books, allowed me to really pick out from the shop the books I wanted, and it gave me about 2 years, I think. But the idea of literally stumbling, if I hadn't come home that one weekend and my mother hadn't been at that one cocktail party, it never would have happened. Someone else would have wound up working there. I don't know who it would have been, but not someone. But it was a fluke. I had worked in the book trade in Boston for about 6 years, I guess, in and around, going to school. But my years at Maurice, I started really going back in. I still run my shop basically the way he ran his shop. It's an antiquated method. But for the type of shop where you have new books, old books, antiquarian books, and it's small enough so you know what you have, on a good day, you know what you have, it's really the only way. So I think he'd be happy to know that a small shop of his, there really hasn't been made a computer program to fit. You go to Oblong Books, yes, they're all on computers. You go to biggest bookstores, and you have to. These days, you have to. But his shop has eluded that type of organization, which I think he still appreciates. And at some point, I hope someone does a biography of, it could be a brief biography of Maurice, as in, I always try to get him to do it, write about himself, but boy, that fell on deaf ears. Never once did he even entertain the idea of writing writing about himself. Because many booksellers have, and they're always entertaining, they're very knowledgeable, you can learn a lot about books through their experience with books, but he never wanted to get in the way, he never wanted his personal life to get in the way of books. And he might also have to admit something in the past, but just his experience with all the books that he handled, a great book. That's pretty much gone now. All of his famous customers, I think, are all all dead. I know people who remember a lot of the books that were in the shop when he died, so you could piece together a fair bit of it. But the main problem is, for the first 40 years, he did it on his own. No one was in there except Maurice. My mother worked for him during Christmas, but it was to wrap packages. I mean, no one ever helped him order books, and go with them on Maurice. Until I got there, he had the heart attack in 68 or 69. He drove down to his Land Rover, got the mail every day, and unwrapped the mail. He had Barbara Constantine type letters to the bill, but the basic selling was all done by Maurice. The buying was all done by Maurice. And so many of the great books will be forgotten. He couldn't resurrect, but he was a unique bookseller.
How did he order if he didn't go into the city? Did he do it by phone?
Well, he did it by phone, did it by catalog. Mm-hmm. He had numerous catalogs, and he got both dealers in this country as well as England, and the continent too. There were some booksellers in Paris and Italy, but some continental booksellers. And this is all contacts that he had made in the 20s. In the 20s, he must have been a world. He did publishing. He published some very influential books. He knew all the best designers. His man, Bruce Rogers. Bruce Rogers did several books for Marie's, famous books. He almost published T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland. He came within a hair's breadth of publishing that. It was because his letter was chugging its way across the Atlantic in a steamship, or a passenger ship, and another hard-boiled publisher was right there in London, heard about it also, and went down and sealed the deal. Whereas Maurice's letter, which he had framed in his shop, saying, "Oh, I'd love to publish your poems, or my Bruce Rogers design it," it would have been one of the great books of the century. And he just missed it. Just missed it. That would have been tricky. Because Aiken, Maurice's great friend, Conrad Aiken, had written him saying, "You've got to see this young poet, T.S. Eliot." And Maurice knew him because Eliot had been in Harvard Square. And Aiken said he has a book of poems he wants to publish. And Aiken thought that Maurice should do it with Maurice's design sense. And unfortunately, before the days of fax machines, it was just too slow. Maurice's accepting letter was too slow. And Horace Liverwright, who was a demon, got there first and signed him up. And subsequently produced a very mediocre, little, frail black book. The gold on the spine wears off, so you don't know what it is. It's a little, slim, black book with no mark. Occasionally, you'll see a copy with the waistline privilege. But the gold it was cheaply done. And so if you see a small, slim black book with no marking on it at all, it's probably Eliot's The Wasteland.
That's a great story.
Well, he published Edward Arlington Robinson, Archibald MacLeish, Conrad Aiken, Henry James, some letters of Henry James, Santayana. What I do want to do, and hope to, is get all the books that he published and write a little bibliography. Because Hugh Macmillan has, I think, most of them. And I have most of them, and I think together we probably have them all. I'm missing about 3 or 4. He did some pamphlets. One pamphlet was so well designed that it won one of the 50 best books of the year in 1923. A little pamphlet. By an alien in Cornport on how to get along in academia, basically. Again, one of the things I get a great sense of design, both stationary as well as books. I mean, he designed some beautiful stationery for people.
I had some.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, he did some monograms, which were striking. And again, in the old days, you could call up Cranes and sit down with a designer and work something out. You couldn't do that today at all. You could make a suggestion, but it would all be done by mail. He, I think, bowed out just about the right time. For someone who would span those many years from certainly the beginning, I'll say the beginning of 20th century publishing, to, it's not the end, it's pretty close to the end. We're pretty computerized. There may be some other innovations in the last 10 years of the century that would change publishing. But he basically saw it from the beginning to the end. And he didn't like the end. He still loved the books. Boy, he loved the books. But the actual day-to-day running of the business, that was just agony.
Well, Mike, I thank you muchly, very, very much.
You're most welcome.
Okay, this is the continuation of the interview on Maurice Ferrusky, and this is the 21st of April, 1989, and we are now... 22nd, is it? Okay. We're now talking to John G. Bowen, who knew Mr. Ferrusky quite well. So, Jerry, you weren't born here.
No, I was born and raised in New Rochelle, New York, but I came to Hotchkiss to school in September 1938. I graduated in June of 1942, had lots of friends here on the faculty and so on, so I came back quite often. And then I came to work here at Hotchkiss in September 1953. Very quickly thereafter, I met Moss, who was then married to Virginia, through Robert Hawkins, and got to know him quite well. Worked off and on at the secretarial capacity, and so forth.
Tell me about Moss Maurice Muz. That's his nickname. How do you spell his nickname?
It's spelled M-U-S. I have it on a couple of letters that he signed, you know, thank you notes for Christmas presents or something of that sort. I had always thought that it only his very close friends called him that, and I did occasionally, but most of the time it was as far as I was concerned.
He came here from Boston?
From Cambridge. The Dunster, I think he called it, the Dunster Street Bookshop, or maybe it was just the Dunster Bookshop, but it is there on a part of town that's now been built up. But he came here, having operated very successfully in right next to Harvard Square for years, which is quite funny in as much as he is one of the world's original Yaleys. But he had built up a successful business there and then transferred here, I think it was 1929, something like that, the bookshop. And it was the best bookshop within a radius of 7,500 miles.
Was it really?
Oh, sure.
Why?
Well, he was experienced and he knew the business backwards and forwards and could get anything he wanted. He had a collection of rare books, as you know. And very hardworking and conscientious. I was trying to think early this morning, the hours. I guess he didn't open till 9, but it was 9 to 5, 6 days a week, 52 weeks a year in the time that I knew him. He never went away. He did in earlier years, but he had somebody to stand in for.
Who, you?
Oh, no. In the first years I knew him, a guy named Victor Borsodi used to stand in for him. But, you know, Barbara Constant and I worked there for decades.
Who was she?
Well, her husband switched finally and worked for the post office in Salisbury because he wanted to build up Social Security or whatever that was. But she used to help out at the bookshop, and John Curry worked there for years. But he made sure that it was open 6 days a week, and so you could tell her how to walk in there and be sure of personal service. And he never went out of his way to bother you. In talk, sure, he would answer any question you had if you wanted to, but if you wanted to spend half an hour browsing and just looking at books in there, you could. He would be at work at his desk.
What kind of a man was he? Was he popular? In town, I mean, did he have a lot of friends?
I think, oh yes, he had a lot of friends. I would find a very entertaining guy to talk to, and he knew all kinds of people, though he was anything but a name dropper. But he was a Melville fan, which is one of the things that I liked. He would lend me, he had a respectable collection of Melville, first edition, it was in a letter, autograph letter, which he would lend me for displaying at the school when we were reading Moby Dick, whatever course. But he knew Henry Murray, if you're a Melville, and you know who he was, and all kinds of people like that. And the business, well, he operated it on an antiquated system, I expect, with cards for each person who charged and so on, and sent out monthly bills that had to be typed up by some myrmidon like me. That's kind of the idea for a while. And some of his best customers wouldn't pay him for months. And it must have cost him a lot of money to send out the monthly statement, brought forward $1,200, whatever. But, people from the movie racket, I think Charlton Heston was a customer of his at one point. And knew you could get whatever they wanted.
Is there anything, any bookshop like that now that you know?
Yes, Virginia, I recall, who was married to when I first got to know them, would handle the cards and that kind of stuff that they also carried. But nowadays, if you think of what's the one in Millerton called?
Long Valley.
There are all kinds of stuff there, tape recordings and compact discs and everything, like a kitchen stove, and a calendar. Well, Virginia managed to carry calendars and things like that. But the Housatonic bookshelf was mainly books, current and past. And he had, as you know, a bargain section there in the room on the right hand as you went in the door. All this stuff that obviously hadn't sold and so on. And then down in the cellar, huge numbers of books. I don't know how long it took me to clear that place out after he died, but there must have been thousands and thousands.
Did you buy?
I used to buy. He was a very shrewd, as I said, a very shrewd businessman. I know when I first knew him, people laughed because a lot of local merchants would give a school teacher a 10% discount. D.I.D.'s and Canaan and so on. This was very nice. Musk never did anything of the sort. You paid the full price, including the tax. But in other ways, he was extremely generous. As you know, a gourmet cook, so was Elvia, his third wife. And if you got invited to dinner there, you got a... Well, the kitchen, I don't know, did you ever see the kitchen? It was lined with cookbooks from floor to ceiling, you know, these guys, they must have been, I don't know how many. He and Elvia published one, the best of Palestine, which was...
You were a good friend.
I think so, and one of the things that impresses me in retrospect was that he and Virginia, they obviously got somebody to hold the fort. You know, they came all the way to Cambridge, Massachusetts today and were married and attended the wedding and attended the reception and drove out to Salisbury. At that point, he was, well, I don't know exactly when he was born. I can find out easily. But,
well, how old was he when he died? Roughly.
I
mean, was he in his 70s?
Easily. I don't remember when he died. I can find that out too. But he was something like 19. 17 or 18 at Yale, so he would have been born, I would think, in the 1890s.
Now he had one child, Ollie.
No, he had one child by Elvia, but he had, I think, two daughters by his first or second wife.
Oh.
And Ollie was Elvia, his child. I've never met the other. I know one of them at least is still alive, and various people used to keep in touch with him.
Can you remember all the wives?
No, not basketball. Well, I remember Elvia because we knew Elvia very well indeed, and Virginia and Betty London.
Was the last one?
Yeah, who just died last summer.
What happened to all those books? Do you remember when he died? Dealers come in?
Yes. There was a woman in Kent who worked there for weeks, if not months. I guess appraising a lot of friends like me and a hawk and God knows how many others would have allowed to take a book or two. But whether most of them were shipped back to the publisher, I don't know. He would have, for example, X copies of the Northwestern Newbery Library edition of Melville as they came out. They're very expensive books, because I'm buying copies for these. but Moby Dick was something like 80 bucks. So, I suppose that many publishers took back some of those things. But the rare books and first editions, God knows.
And the house just went on the market?
No, because after all, Betty was given lifetime occupancy. I always thought that Elvia had a 51% interest in that house or something that she kept after the divorce, but that is not true.
In the house or the business?
The house. I don't think the business at all. But if that had been true, obviously it would have been left to Ollie. After Betty's death, it wasn't. And first it was used for antiques. Now it's a real estate and...
Harney.
Harney team. I haven't said for him since.
But that's where he started.
In Salisbury. Oh, yes. And he made very sure that the name would die with him. It was not to be continued by anybody.
How did you know that?
I do. Either he told me that, or I was told by somebody. And you know, the whole, whether it's an attempt to imitate the Indian spelling, I don't know, the Masonic, so you see, I remember once you got a communication from some outfit in Japan addressed to the House Atomic Bookshop. That's the kind of stuff he would stick on the bulletin board on the right of the wall as you walked in the front door. Various funny things that came up.
Were you here when the Salisbury Players were active?
No.
But he was very much involved in it.
No. And of course, during the war, at any rate, he used to teach at Salisbury School, part or full time. So he obviously, before I knew him, got around a good deal more than he did afterwards.
He did most of his ordering by mail, by phone.
A lot by phone. Mm-hmm. A lot by mail, too. And the last few years, his health was not all that red hot, and he had trouble with cataracts and so on. And, well, when I first knew him, not only a gourmet cook, but he also enjoyed a drink or two before dinner. And if one went into the bookshop at 4 to 5 or something, they would pull the shades down and shut the place up because he insisted on opening on the dot of 9 o'clock and closing the dot of 5. And if there was a bore lingering in the bookshop, he would roll up his eyes and try to get him out. Anyway, if you went in around to a book, most of the times they won't stay for a knock-in or something. The last few years, I don't think he was allowed to drink. But he kept on virtually the day he died. I remember George Stone told me.
Is that right? Okay, same day. 22nd of April, 9, and now I'm with Robert Hawkins. Okay, Robert.
I came to Lakeville in the fall of 1945 to teach at the Hotchkiss School, and one of the first people I met who was not associated with the school was Maurice Brewski. I began a long friendship, which I must say was not always a smooth one, and toward the end we saw very little of each other. Basically, I found Maurice a scoundrel, albeit a charming one, and a person who showed me a great deal of kindness from time to time, a great deal of interest, and yet I found his relationship with people who later became near and dear to me so reprehensible that I do not have a very soft spot in my heart for him. Let me tell you what I know about Maurice's background. He came from a Brooklyn Jewish family, and he denied to me, or at least he gave me the impression that he was did not have that kind of background. His father owned a series of warehouses, and I think the family had some money. His father died when Reese was rather young, and he had nothing thereafter to do with his mother. He had two sisters, or perhaps three. There was a Hortense Seligman, I remember one of them, whom I never met. And and the other one or two sisters, I've forgotten their names, but they were devout Jews who went to temple and didn't deny any of their Jewish background. Mus did, and that bothered me. His daughter, Ali, never realized until after her father's death that she had any Jewish blood, and she found it out because she went to see his sisters and became aware of her background that time. Mus went to Yale when he was very young, and I think probably a very confident scholar, and was called Mus because of the Latin word for mouse, because he was a little fellow. And he didn't give one the impression of being of small stature, but he was not really a large man. Immediately upon leaving Yale, he went up to Cambridge, where he founded Dunster House, a bookstore of extraordinary importance, and he formed around him a kind of coterie, or really a salon. People like Blackmore and Carmen Aiken and Rachel Field were among some of the habitués of this bookstore. He did some publishing. He published some Blackmore, some Carmen Aiken, and some T.S. Eliot. While Maurice was up there, and I don't really remember the, or I don't know that I ever really knew the chronology of events, but he married, and the scuttlebutt is that it was a shotgun marriage, and it didn't last very long. However, he did produce two daughters, his wife did, and Maurice became, in a short time, persona non grata in Cambridge because he was selling Lady Chatterley's Lover under the counter, and he was told to get the hell up. In the meantime, he had fallen in love with a woman by the name of Lizzie Brody, a very competent scholar, and she began teaching at Vassar. Mus would come down from Cambridge to visit her at Vassar, and in those days, of course, there wasn't any mass turnpike, and so he would come down through Hartford and whatever, Route 15, if that was there. Anyway, he took Route 44 for a good part of the way because it goes right to Poughkeepsie, and he became charmed by this town, as almost all of us have, and founded in 1929 the Housatonic Bookshop. He was still married to Lizzie at this time, but on the scene appeared Elvia Scoville. Elvia was not a popular young girl, and she, I don't think it had any bows. Maurice, always having an eye for the best chance, decided that perhaps it'd be nice if he married Elvia. Elvia's mother, Orlena Scoville, one of the great women of my experience, entertained Maurice. Maurice was a marvelous guest, and he had charm and the kind of person you like to have in your drawing room, because he always added to it by his conversation and by his wit and savoir-faire and savoir-dire. He was certainly accomplished socially. I remember one of Orlena's good friends, Pete Miner, saying to me, she was there for dinner one time when Mus was there, and Orlena, Elvia Scoville's mother, said, "Don't you have a place in your bookshop for my daughter?" And well, he said yes, he could find a job for her, and that developed into a romance. He got rid of Lizzie by telling her he thought it'd be nice if she went out to Europe for the summer, and he escorted her down to New York, and when he got her on the boat, he said, "Don't come back. I'm divorcing you." And that was the first she knew that she was to be discarded by Maurice. He was to discard two more wives after that. Lizzie, I knew, not well. But I met her a few times. She had a very good friend here by the name of Lucy Talcott, who was a teacher of some renown at Vassar. Lizzie Brody Peruski, after being divorced from Maurice, married the Harvard, I think he was an Austrian, economist Schumpeter, a very famous man. I didn't know Maurice in any of those days. I got to know him when he was married to Elvia, and they had been, by the time I knew them, married for, I think, 11 or 12 years. Holly, whom I like very much indeed, and one of my dear friends, was about 10 years old. One would go there, the hospitality at the Peruski house was generous and gracious, more to drink than anybody ever needed. I was impressed, coming from a very simple South Dakota background, by the hospitality and the excellent food and the wines and the cocktails and all of that kind of thing. I think that Musk was genuine in his hospitality. I don't think there was any ulterior motive in that. He did some very nice things for me. My second year here, I was asked to address a group that called itself the Serious Thinkers and Drinkers of Sage Ravine. And I was, if I may put it this way, young for my age. And I did a report on C.S. Lewis, and I don't recall what I said, but I suspect it wasn't very good. However, there was a master up in Berkshire, and I was trying to think of his name the other day, a man who resented Hotchkiss because he wanted to come to Hotchkiss to teach and hadn't been hired, and so he decided that he would do anything nasty he could about Hotchkiss. And I remember when I got through speaking, he stood up and said, "You're a credit to your school and to your mother." Then he started zeroing in on me, and I was lost. Lost just because I didn't have the courage or the sophistication to know how to handle them. I was 22 years old and inexperienced with all this kind of thing. And Musk came to my rescue and managed to save me from a situation that was very embarrassing. And I was always grateful to him for that. I was able, in later years, to return some of Maurice's kindness by, when he was having trouble with wife number four, coming and holding his hand, and when he was ill, coming and staying in the house at night because she would leave. It was a tawdry situation. And he was sick and needed somebody there, and I served as a kind of confidential nurse, if there is such a thing. I got to know Maurice and Elvia very, very well indeed, and was shocked when Musk wrote me a letter saying that he and Elvia were going to be divorced. And that's really, I remember how surprised I was, because I had no idea that marriage was as rocky as it was, because when we went there, there were people of good taste and good manners, and they never showed any antipathy, no squabbling or anything of that sort. Elvia had a reputation for having boyfriends, and Musk was supposed to have had some girlfriends, and I know a lot of those stories, but I don't think they're significant. I couldn't prove them, and I think they're a little too infradict to include in something of this sort. But I think to get a just picture of Maurice Peruski, the best bookseller I think anybody could have, the Housatonic Bookshop was like no other bookshop, and I've been in some very good ones, but it had a charm and a literary quality that I just have never experienced elsewhere. Maurice, shortly after he divorced Elvia, divorced him. I mean, he was just gentleman enough to let the women get the divorces, although he would go to Las Vegas and establish residency in that. He married a very, very strange woman indeed. Virginia, Russ, Burnham Barnett. She was the daughter of an Ohio businessman. I think there was some money there in the family. Tell you what she was like. Her favorite poet was Edgar Guest. And
I thought she was Virginia Ward.
Well, she became Ward later on. But she, her first marital arrangement was with her father's groom, and she ran off with him. Well, that was extinguished somewhere or there, I think, annulled. And then she married a man by the name of Frank Barnett. Frank died just a couple of years ago. They had one son, John, who sent his son to Hotchkiss. John died in a diving accident. He was diving for the Andrea Doria some years after it had sunk, and he died, I don't know exactly how, whether it was a heart attack or what, while he was diving. Virginia was a mightily strange woman, and she relied on me to do a lot of things, and I was beginning to be put in the position of taking sides. Elvia never did that kind of thing. And I could be Maurice's good friend and her good friend, and that was all right, but with Virginia, you had to take sides. Virginia was finally left Maurice, and then she married a man named Ferrari Ward. Ferrari Ward had been married twice before. I think he was divorced from his first wife, and then he married Miss Muriel Elbert from a very, very old Connecticut family. Matter of fact, the family came from Goshen, but they were the people who founded the Torrington Company. And they had a lovely old house in Prospect Street in Hartford. And then the marvelous property called Isola Bella. And when Muriel died, Frey Ward lived out there. And then when he married Virginia, they lived on Isola Bella. They hadn't been married very long when Frey Ward dropped dead of a heart attack, and the will specified that upon his death, the property would have to go to the American School for the Deaf, which indeed it has done. And that was more upsetting to Virginia, I think, than to have Frey dead, because she loved the property. But she had to get out, and she built a house, which I have never seen, but imitating the property on Isola Bella. I don't know exactly how Virginia died. She and I became completely estranged. Any relationship with her was very stormy, and she all of a sudden took a violent dislike to me, and I can understand why people would do that. That I don't find so strange, but I'd like to know the reason. But she did it to other people too, and was found dead at the bottom of the basement stairs in her house. And the irony there is that Elvia, his second wife, who became a very close friend of mine, I personally found her dead at the bottom of her stairs in her house on Wooden Drive. But that's all another story. After his Virginia, he married Betty Wonder, and I think, from what I could gather, it was a very congenial relationship, and he died before Betty did. Elvia used to joke and say that she would be longer in office than anyone, and I think she was, because they were married about 18 years. Russ had two daughters by his first wife. Did I mention that earlier?
I think you did.
Okay.
Yeah.
And one of them married Walton Green's son. And there are some of the facts of Maurice's life. I cannot stress strong enough how many hours of pleasure the bookstore gave me and hours of pleasure I had as a guest in his house under two incumbents, under Elpia and under Virginia. But I think the thing that has distressed me toward the end is that his daughter, Ollie, who really is a person of great affection, he paid very little attention to her. Now, Ollie has plenty of this world's goods, I think, from her mother, because the school was not poor people, and there was family trusts that keep going on and provide a lot of people with a lot of money. But Ollie wanted desperately a large salad bowl that her father had. Now this sounds very strange, but it was representing the kind of thing Maurice did, and Ollie would have even paid her father for it. And it was a superb salad bowl, and he made a marvelous salad, very good salad, very famous. Matter of fact, he and Elvia did a cookbook called The Best of Woolstamp, and I have an autographed copy of that somewhere, and I still use it occasionally. It's a very good cookbook. But Maurice just went off and sold it to an antique dealer in Washington. And I know Ollie was distressed by that because she would have, it was a matter of money. And I don't think Maurice ever had very much money. And I think that his books really were his assets. I don't think he was a man with the usual assets that people have, stocks and bonds and certificates of deposit and that kind of thing. When Betty, the last wife, died, things that had belonged to Maurice, that had been given him by his third mother-in-law, Orlena Scoville, went into an auction, and Ollie had to go down and buy at the auction some of the possessions which her father had acquired through Ollie's grandmother. And when I would go there, when Ollie was little, I'd say, okay, Ollie, go upstairs. Must had a mustache, and he had a disconcerting habit of sniffing, and always sniffing, and he'd brush this mustache away this way. Okay, Ollie, go upstairs. Go upstairs, and poor little Ollie would be sent upstairs. And I sometimes felt that her mother could have been a little more defensive than she was, but again, it was a family matters. And Must did not leave Ollie anything when he died, and that property on the main street of Salisbury is of some value, I would think. And I do not believe he left his daughters by his first marriage anything. And his last wife got everything, and she has one cretin of a, or had one cretin of a adopted son who's been in a loony bin all of his life, and I think he probably got everything.
Go. All right. I have three anecdotes I'd like to tell you about. Maurice there a bit, mischievous perhaps. They first had to do with his third wife, Elvia, who was a very dear friend of mine, and Elvia had come one day for cocktails, and I had a couple other people, one of whom was a woman from out of town. She was visiting her daughter, who was the wife of my colleagues, in the same building as I did. And she had been over to the Stanley bookshop and had, of course, been thrown by it, as we all were when we went into the place. And she had not apparently got Elvia's name when I introduced it, and she said, oh, I just met the most wonderful man in the world, and this first man, I'm going to marry him. And Elvia said, you might as well, everybody else has. Then a second incident occurred in the Ustami bookshop. I was not there to hear this, but it was told me by somebody who was there. Must's fourth wife was Virginia, and the woman came in and said she would like to meet, like to speak to Mrs. Ferusky. And she said, well, I am Mrs. Ferusky. Oh, and I might interrupt here by saying that Elvie had a very black hair, which she grew back very severely into a black hair. And it was an outstanding feature of her appearance. And this woman said, oh, Mrs. Ferusky, I knew had black hair.
Well, I second Mrs. Bruce, said Virginia. Elder's comment, when she heard that, was she needs a goddamn daddy machine. And the third story has to do with the final flight. Elder and I had been invited to a cocktail party, and we were leaving. Fire Justice Musk came in with Betty, and Elder went up to her, just a couple of days after their marriage, and went up to her and said, "You're the bravest woman in Salisbury." Musk was a fine teacher, and I've had several people who were taught by him at the Salisbury School say that he was an extraordinarily good teacher. I should mention quickly, he was a very well-informed person, and he had a sense of humor that was, well, delightful, I think, would be the way to put it. He had a charming manner, and I think those things carried over to the classroom. People remember him with affection as with gratitude. Remember, he's a teacher of affection and gratitude.
I was just going to say, I thought Mike McCabe had said something about he felt that Musk always put books ahead of wives and children, and you, I think, felt that, what, put them ahead of everything?
He put them ahead of everything, and I'm afraid I'm not generous enough to forgive him his treatment of his wives and his daughters. He did some, as I said earlier, I think some very, very cruel things.
Okay, Robert, thanks very much.
That do it?
That does it. Okay, good.